industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Hello, everyone. It is my honor to introduce Dr. Lorraine Murphy, a distinguished faculty member at Temple University and expert toxicologist. Today on Toxic History, Dr. Murphy will take us on a fascinating journey through the madness of King George III, exploring how historical events and decisions have shaped our understanding of toxic substances and their impact on human health. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Lorraine Murphy.
Who's ready for Toxic History? All right, let's go ahead and get started. So who is the Mad King George? There are lots of kings named George in the history of time. We're specifically going to talk about King George III of England. Some of you may recognize him from his role on the Broadway musical Hamilton. Some of you may remember that he should have been married to Queen Charlotte in the Netflix series Bridgerton, though he doesn't show up. And some of you may recognize him from the Bridgerton spin-off series Queen Charlotte. If you have seen this, it does not grieve me to tell you. That is, it is horrendously historically inaccurate. Now, historians and physicians alike have been intrigued by the enigma of his mysterious illness, trying to reconcile the coexistence of severe physical symptoms with psychiatric changes. Many argue that he simply had bipolar disorder, and others argue that he had porphyria. But perhaps there's another answer, a toxic answer. If we are going to postulate a poisonous source of his plights, we must first do a little research. We need to understand who he was, when he lived, and get an idea of the state of the medical field at the time. So, if you'll join me, let's travel to the year 1738. Attendance. No, the clip is here, come fix it. No. Is that clip off? Okay.
No problem. Yeah, no problem.
Oh yes, I'm not gonna talk like that. All right, so when baby George was young, he wasn't in direct line to the throne, it was his dad. Now, King George II was his grandfather, and baby George's dad died at the age of 44 of pneumonia. So young George was a teenager, and he looked eagerly for male mentorship while preparing to be king. He found a father figure in one of his tutors, John Stuart, the third Earl of Bute. Now, his tutor became very close with his widowed mother and developed increasing influence and power in court. Now, historians doubt they were lovers, but the public at the time was absolutely convinced that George's mother was having an affair with this nobleman. Why am I talking about this? Well, this particular male figure was significantly beloved by teenage George and had much influence in his approach to politics. He would contribute to much strife later in British history when the question of regency arose during King George's illness. Foreshadowing. All right, so Grandpa King George lived until 76. He dies of a thoracic aortic aneurysm quite suddenly, and our baby George was 22, now making him King George III of England. Now that he's king, he makes a political marriage to the German princess Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, and they were said to love each other quite dearly. He was said to have never taken a mistress, in stark contrast to his grandfather and offspring, and they had 15 kids. All right, how about some concurrent events in the history of King George's reign? Well, at the time of his ascension to the throne, England was in the midst of the Seven Years' War, a war involving nearly all of the great powers in Europe, which would be quite apropos for his future reign as he would traverse through many wars as king, including the American Revolutionary War, the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, and the War of 1812. In addition to these monumental military events, his reign coincided with that of Catherine the Great of Russia, the majority of the life of Beethoven, the entire life of Mozart, the first administration of the smallpox vaccine, the first trip of the steam locomotive, and the world's population reached 1 billion for the first time in history. Now that we have some historical context, let us turn to the state of the medical field that would be doing its very best to treat any illnesses of the King of England. The predominant theory of treating physical disease in the 1700s was still based on balancing the four humors of the body: blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. During this time, some better theories were just starting to get developed, like maybe miasmas or foul air could spread disease, or maybe an organ could cause disease in its own right. Unfortunately, these ideas were still being developed during his reign. They were not widespread, and they had not been present long enough to change treatments away from what was tried and true. Shifting those humors back into place with bloodletting, cathartics, also called purgatives, which are both names for laxatives, vomiting, and medical blistering. Now, cupping was also used, and sure, there were creams, liniments, ointments, tonics, some medicines. Sometimes they involved herbs that had physiologic action, and sometimes they didn't, and also sometimes they had heavy metals. So, with this context, let's examine the major medical events in King George's life. We'll examine his symptoms at different stages of his illness, explore why someone claimed he had porphyria, and then we'll take a look and see if any of the treatments he could have received could have caused some of his symptoms. Most historians agree that George suffered either four or five relevant periods of major illness. There was a respiratory illness at the age of 27 without any mental illness. Then he was quite well until the age of 50. He had a significant illness lasting over 9 months. This interval is best documented and provides the majority of historical details of his symptoms. We'll spend a bit more time here. He then was returning to normal health and wasn't sick for about 10 years. He had a recurrence of mental illness at the age of 62 for a few months, and again at the age of 65 for a few weeks. Finally, the last decade of his life is often called permanent madness, suggesting that he was in a chronic psychotic state lasting 9 years until his death. With this outline, let's take a dive into each of the five episodes. Though not always included in the history of his madness, he suffered a notable illness at the age of 27 that I think warrants a brief review. He became sick enough at this young age that many feared he would die. A bit unusual for someone in their 20s, maybe not unheard of in the 1700s. He developed a respiratory illness, and the doctors feared the worst: consumption. Now, the symptoms were pretty unremarkable. He had a cough, sharp chest pains, a hoarse voice, and it lasted about 3 months. For a brief period, he was so sick that he was confined to bed and unable to participate in his duties. This led to the first discussions of a regency plan, where the previously referenced father figure, Earl of Bute, comes back into play. Per tradition, it was expected that the king should name his queen, Queen Charlotte, to rule as regent until one of his children could become old enough to take over the throne. However, he instead issued a controversial statement that the appointment should be left to the royal discretion when the time came. What? This immediately aroused suspicion among not only his family members, but also his leading staff members. If you're going to deviate from the plan, why not just name an appropriate substitute? There was suspicion that George had intentions to make a deathbed nomination of an unlikely, unpredicted, and unliked candidate, such as his favorite Lord Bute. The king did not clarify his statement, recovered health, everyone ignored it, just swept that under the rug, though it may have left a bit of sour taste in everyone's mouth. Now, King George recovered without any permanent illness. But for about 2 months afterwards, he had an unusually dark and sullen mood, and some historians suspect that this could have represented a depressive episode. There are no clear records of abnormal behaviors attributed to this respiratory illness, but it is also known that the royal family had several documents destroyed that may have been compromising regarding his behavioral changes occurring towards the end of his illness. George led a healthy life free of any major notable medical illnesses for the next 20 years. This encompassed the American Revolution in its entirety, so it cannot be said that his illness or madness contributed to Britain's loss of the American colonies. When he was 48, He survived an attempted assassination attempt when a woman in a crowd lunged at him with a knife. Finally, political and family life had calmed down, and 1 week after celebrating a peaceful 50th birthday, he developed abdominal pain. The next 9 months would be one of the most remarkable of his life. His symptoms started with what was referred to as a bilious attack, a period of severe abdominal pain and cramping. It confined him to bed. It was unresponsive to all the first-line treatments of the royal physicians, which were emetics and purgatives. He was advised that he should travel and drink the mineral waters at Cheltenham Springs. These were rumored to be helpful for bilious complaints. So up he left with the queen and a couple of his daughters for Cheltenham, and would you know it, after just a couple days of drinking that water every day at 6 a.m., his pain resolved without any treatment at all once he had left the palace. Suspicious? Maybe those waters are curative. He then returned to normal health for 2 months. 6 weeks later, he developed the same abdominal pain, but it was more severe and with new symptoms. He had joint pain, muscle fatigue, a transient rash on his skin that was described as, quote, as if he had been scourged by cords. The physicians couldn't figure out what was going on and had to conclude that he was suffering a severe case of rheumatism due to not changing his stockings after a hunting trip. They treated him with laudanum when he had abdominal pain, bloodletting, purgatives, vomiting, and cupping. About a week into these symptoms, he developed new associated symptoms. He had intermittent fevers, at one point was noted to have edema of the legs, had a brief episode of respiratory difficulties, and at least one episode of dark urine. At this point, he started developing a progressive insomnia. They continued to give him emetics and laxatives, and they added a new treatment called Peruvian bark. I know you're curious. We'll come back to that later. After 2 to 3 weeks of these physical symptoms, personality changes occurred. It started with subtle symptoms of increased anger, occasional ranting at physicians, and progressively worsening insomnia. He then developed a psychiatric state that would be best described in modern times as a manic episode in the setting of a bipolar disorder. This is evidenced by doctors' descriptions, family reports, eyewitness accounts, and from letters written from the king at the time. His symptoms included, quote, an extreme quickness of speech. Instructions were given so rapidly that one put out the other almost immediately from recollection. I believe this would be interpreted today as pressured speech. He displayed occasional fixation on religious topics. He had grandiose plans. He focused on performing projects that didn't exist. He had uncharacteristically rude and hypersexualized speech, and his conversations didn't follow a logical train of thought. He was found talking continuously for hours at a time, and he wrote sentences over 400 words long. He only slept about 3 hours a night, and sometimes didn't sleep for 72 hours at a time. His family and physicians agreed to move him to the palace at Kew in order to keep him out of the public eye, remove him from family stress, and give him the ability to walk around outside without being disturbed while his physicians were trying to figure out what to do. Now, it's very interesting. When he had these psychiatric symptoms, there was a change in his physical symptoms. The initial abdominal pain, the leg pain, myalgias, the urine changes, those were gone. He did not have those at all at this point. Instead, he was having episodes of intermittent fevers, recurrent night sweats, though he was often restrained in his bed to try and sleep, and he developed new symptoms of blurry vision or altered color vision and hearing changes. One of the most tragic things is that he would occasionally display lucid intervals, and during these times he had awareness of his illness and had extreme shame regarding his behavior. After 1 month, the royal physicians could not find an effective treatment, and the royal family brought in a new provider, Reverend Francis Willis, a clergyman turned medical practitioner who specialized in the treatment of the insane. Now, Sir Francis Willis practiced medicine at a sanatorium in Grateford Hall. He employed up-to-date treatments for the insane, which avoided the physical punishment, which was standard of care at the time, and instead relied on restraints, but also encouraged manual labor and participation in activities of daily living. At this point, His physical symptoms had completely resolved. He was having primarily psychiatric symptoms, and this lasted for 3 additional months. During this time, they continued to give him emetics and purgatives, and they continually applied blistering agents to his legs. He was frequently restrained in a straitjacket or a restraining chair, and this could be for hours at a time, all while separated from his family at the palace at Kew. By the end of February, his lucid intervals increased in frequency and duration until he returned fully to his baseline mental status. By this point, he was deemed cured, but he was very fatigued and had lost a lot of weight. Over the next year, he returned to his full physical status, regained the weight, and was not described to have any significant lingering medical illnesses. The king then functioned normally for the next 11 years. No recurrence or relapse of his illness. So now we have progressed through a respiratory illness, maybe with depression and a sprinkle of drama, through a new prolonged episode that started with recurrent abdominal pain, followed by muscular changes, some weird leg edema, hematuria, and then at the end, purely mania. King George did fairly well over the next several years, even surviving 2 additional separate assassination attempts via shooting at the age of 61. The next major recurrence of his illness occurred in 1801 at the age of 62. They started in winter with a respiratory cold, for which they treated him with emetics. This was followed by abdominal cramping, similar to his previous symptoms of a bilious attack. They treated him with the same therapies, emetics, cathartics, blistering. This time, after only 1 week of abdominal pain, he developed behavioral changes. This started with increasing talkativeness, followed by insomnia, increased anger responses, until all the same behavioral changes from 1788 manifested once again. At one point during this episode, he was noted to speak continuously for 19 hours without stopping. They gave him laudanum once again for pain, Peruvian bark, emetics, laxatives, and blistering of the legs. They tried a couple new things this time. They gave him calomel once or twice. They soaked his feet in vinegar, and they tried a starvation diet. Now, when he refused his medicines, they would force feed them to him once again or hide them in his food. And once again, his physical symptoms resolved once the mania emerged. They reinstituted the restraining chair and the straitjacket, and he once again developed intermittent fevers, night sweats, myalgias, 1 episode of leg edema, 1 episode of hematuria, and then once again complained of decreased visual acuity and hearing problems. Now, after only 1 week, he started having lucid intervals. And then one of his doctors heard a strange remedy. They said, you know, I think sleeping on a pillow made of warm hops can cure illness. Why don't we try that? So the doctor procured said satchel of warm hops, fashioned a pillow for the king, and would you know it, but that's the first time he slept 8 hours in a row. So maybe we need to try that again. The entire episode from his physical symptoms to his recovery this time was only a total of 3 months. He was once again fatigued, starved, and emaciated, but he could participate fully with all his duties, engage in regular conversations, and perform his duties as king. This time his vision may have not fully recovered, but his mental faculties were clear. This episode in 1801 had many similarities to 1788, but this time it was much shorter, lasting only 1 month. His third major illness occurred only 3 years later when he was 65. This time, he once again developed upper respiratory symptoms and then was described as having a gouty attack. He was treated again with emetics, purgatives, blistering, and after a few days of these symptoms, he developed increased talkativeness, followed by fevers and muscle aches. He then developed insomnia, pressured speech, and again the previous symptoms of mania returned. All the previous therapies were reinitiated. This time, however, his symptoms lasted 1 week before he started to recover. When he did recover, he now had a new permanent deficit. He felt that he had completely lost his vision and his hearing was quite poor. In comparison to his episodes in 1801 and 1788, this one was a little bit different. He didn't have any abdominal pain, skin changes, leg edema, rashes, urine changes, all of that was gone. And this episode was much shorter. The king lived a fairly illness-free life for 7 more years before his final illness episode, which occurred in October of 1810 and at the age of 72. His favorite daughter, his youngest daughter Amelia, died of measles. He was devastated. While arranging her matters after death, he developed a chest cold. This was treated with emetics, of course. And then he started developing episodes of confusion and delirium with pressured speech and agitation at night. This episode did not share any of the previous symptomology of his prior episodes. No physical symptoms aside from the cold that resolved. He occasionally exhibited prolonged talking, agitation, and disorganized illogical thoughts, and once again had progressive insomnia. From here, he passed into nightly confusion and vague but redirectable disorientation. Though many non-medical writers describe this phase as permanent descent into madness, a bit sensationalized, his behavioral changes would be best described by modern physicians as progressive dementia. His doctors again provided the first-line therapies at the time, which still included things to make him vomit. He exhibited wandering behavior, slept poorly, and was often up at night. After one entire year without any improvement, the Regency Act was initiated, and his son, King George IV, took over as regent. At this point, the king was almost completely blind and deaf. He stopped recognizing family members. He would never again recover his memory or his mental faculties. Living a quiet but confused life, he spent his time going on walks with assistants, playing the harpsichord for hours at a time, and he remained in this final state for another 8 years. He was incapable of knowing when his wife died in 1818, and in January of 1820, he died of pneumonia at Windsor Castle. So to review. Aside from having a severe respiratory illness at the age of 27, King George III was relatively healthy until the age of 50. His chief physical symptoms during the first two episodes were quite similar: abdominal pain, leg swelling, maybe rashes, a lot of muscular symptoms, fevers and sweats. But a lot of these symptoms resolved when he developed progressive mania. Now, the two shorter episodes did not involve any abdominal pain or urine changes, and his later episodes were never as severe. After the last one, he was permanently blind. The last 10 years of his life are better described as dementia rather than psychosis. The mystery in the king's illness lays in trying to generate a link between these concurrent physical symptoms and the psychiatric changes. This is why the theory that the king had porphyria became popular. In the 1960s, a mother and son, doctor duo, researched King George III as part of their work while writing a history of psychiatry book. They decided the king never had mental illness. Instead, he had a metabolic disorder that resulted in signs of mental illness. They said variegate porphyria. Oh, duh, variegate porphyria, that makes sense. We all remember that easily without stress or anxiety from our previous medical testing. I don't remember that at all. So for the sake of education, I thought it would be very helpful today to go through all of heme metabolism and the 8 porphyrias. Yeah, right, this is a tox lecture. Absolutely not. Okay, but for reals, I'll give you a quick summary of porphyria so we can understand the context, and then I'll explain why I don't think this is the case for the king. So, porphyria, it's not one disease, there's 8. It involves problems with heme creation. That sounds familiar, we got that. It's part of hemoglobin. It performs a number of diverse functions in the body that maybe some of us forgot about when we became toxicologists like Loren. It forms essential parts of catalases, peroxidases, and our cytochrome systems, and it also has regulatory roles in the neurologic system. Who knew? Now we know. Now, we're not going to go through this, don't worry. Heme creation has multiple steps. It's very complex, but depending on what step is inhibited, you get different diseases. Now, all the diseases can be put into 2 major categories. There are people who are normally healthy and well, and then they get these acute inducible attacks that can be deadly, and then they do not have any skin rashes or changes. And then there's a group who has chronic skin blistering rashes, but no other physical symptoms, and they always have the rash. Now, there's only a single disorder that's a mix between having rashes and inducible attacks, and this is called variegate porphyria. This is the one that the 2 psychiatrists conveniently decided King George III had. Now, We can't go back in time and perform gold standard genetic mutation testing to diagnose this disease, but the symptoms of this medical illness are very unique. So let's go through somebody having a patient with variegate porphyria and what the attack looks like, and we can compare that to King George III. First of all, this first episode of illness will typically occur by age 30, if not a little bit earlier, a couple years after. Already a little bit different from George. He was 50 when he first had his major illness. The most common symptoms with every single attack are abdominal pain that is cramping and diffuse, dark urine from the heme precursors, tachycardia and hypertension, and a very specific blistering skin rash with hypopigmentation. Now, about 50% of the time, people who are having a porphyria attack will have muscular changes, and an even smaller proportion of the time, they can have mental status changes. We can see how someone on the surface might take all these symptoms and be like, hey, abdominal pain and a rash and urine changes, and he felt weak, and he was crazy. That sounds like King George. But there's some very important things that were looked over when assigning this diagnosis, and when we look closer, we see that it probably doesn't fit at all. First of all, these symptoms have to occur with every single attack. King George's last two significant mental illness episodes didn't have any of the most important standard symptoms of a porphyria attack. No abdominal pain, no rashes, no urine color changes. We already know that two of his manic episodes didn't match up, which already makes this an unlikely diagnosis. But there's more. First of all, the symptoms, the urine change that happens needs to occur throughout the entire attack, not just momentarily. For King George, he only had hematuria mentioned twice in his life, or dark urine rather. Next, the description of his skin rash doesn't match. Porphyria has a very specific blistering rash, and he was never described to have any blistering aside from the blisters that they administered to his legs as part of medical therapy. One of the most important differences is how muscular weakness was interpreted by the psychiatrists. Throughout King George's medical notes, he was noted to have muscular cramping, generalized fatigue, and muscle aches. In stark contrast, the muscle changes associated with variegate porphyria are a progressive paralysis that starts with wrist drop and foot drop, and then in most people, it will fully progress to quadriparesis and then respiratory arrest and death, which didn't happen to King George, even though he had muscular symptoms. And that would have happened before any modern therapy was available like we have today. Now, the psychiatrist team also decided to ignore any other symptoms that didn't match up with the variegate porphyria. So they simply decided not to explain his intermittent vision changes or hearing changes, the leg edema, his night sweats, or his fevers. But let's turn to the elephant in the room, the psychiatric changes. Porphyria is a very unique disease in that you can have a metabolic disorder that results in psychiatric changes. That makes it a very tempting diagnosis until you learn more about what that means. When we review modern case series, mental status changes are not the rule. They are the exception and occur rarely. And when they do occur, the most common symptom is delirium and confusion. Now, there are case reports and rarer cases of people who have hallucinations and symptoms that look a bit like schizophrenia. And even more rarely, there are a few cases of people with mania. The most important thing about the psychiatric changes is that they are concurrent with all the other physical symptoms of the attack. They start with the abdominal pain, they end when the abdominal pain is over. That's almost complete contrast to King George. He only developed mania symptoms later in his illness when most of his physical symptoms, and importantly, any of the physical symptoms that could be attributed to porphyria, were gone. Just to drive the point home, let's talk about the genetic aspect of the disease. It's autosomal dominant, so it should show up in his predecessors and his descendants. Now, only 10% of people with the mutation will have attacks. That's kind of lucky, and that can make it look like it skips generations. But there are simply no relatives showing up in King George's line who are known to have porphyria. Now, there have been claims by the psychiatry team looking at very cursory medical notes from the 1500s and assigning the diagnosis of porphyria based on a king having one episode of hematuria but no other symptoms. So there are claims that he had predecessors and descendants, but none of them were proven, including in any modern relatives. Currently, there are over 450 living relatives of the House of Hanover, George's relatives in England, and none of the patients who have porphyria in England currently claim a relation to this house. Okay. So we can see how a diagnosis of porphyria is exciting and tempting on the surface, but that's only because it's a poorly understood and rare disease, and understanding the inconsistency of key aspects of his physical symptoms and the lack of living relatives with porphyria makes it a very unlikely diagnosis. So we're back to the start. Why did King George III have such strange physical symptoms when he had psychiatric changes? After I reviewed his medical history, it seems pretty undebatable that he suffered from bipolar disorder with manic episodes. These were likely triggered by mundane medical illnesses or maybe psychiatric stress. He did have severe abdominal pain with body aches and fever, but that could have been explained by a number of different causes, like infectious illnesses or biliary colic. Transient dark urine isn't totally weird. It's a little unusual. What's more perplexing is his persistent muscle cramps and spasms and his prolonged duration of intermittent fevers and night sweats. I think the strangest thing is his reversible but notable change in visual and auditory acuity. An alternate theory is that at least some of these symptoms could be ascribed to his iatrogenic injury from the medicines given to him at the time. We see an attempt at balancing the humors as a recurring theme throughout King George's life. Some of these were unlikely to cause any significant physical effects, but were probably uncomfortable. Cupping probably didn't do much. Recurrent bloodletting could have certainly contributed to his ongoing fatigue, but it's probably not going to cause any of his stranger symptoms. He received laudanum for pain, that's a tincture of opium and ethanol, but none of his symptoms suggest a primary opioid toxicity such as opioid overdose or withdrawal. We get a bit more traction when we turn to his medical blistering. Both mustard plasters and cantharidin plasters were used to create blisters, but the chief blistering agent used for the king was cantharidin, also known as Spanish fly. Spanish fly is most well known for its supposed aphrodisiac effects, and it's derived from the Mediterranean blister beetle, Cantharis or Lita vesicatoria. It's a toxic terpenoid, and though oral ingestion has been used throughout the ages as a sexual stimulant, it has many other additional uses. In medieval times, it was used for pain from kidney stones, kidney or bladder infections, bladder spasms, venereal diseases, we're seeing a theme. It has also been used in the form of an ointment. This was used for joint pains, myalgias, maybe pneumonia. How about whatever rash you have? Cantharidin mechanism of action is not fully understood, but it's thought that it inhibits protein phosphatases that leads to altered endothelial permeability. This causes dysfunction of the endothelial barrier and subsequent edema and swelling. This is the mechanism by which it seems to result in priapism because of the vascular engorgement and inflammation of the genitourinary tract upon elimination. Now, when applied locally to the skin, it causes skin breakdown and blisters, duh. When ingested, it causes a caustic type injury to the mucosal membranes. Interestingly, exposure via both routes can lead to primary renal toxicity, which can result in hematuria, proteinuria, kidney impairment, and oliguria. For King George, he had this applied as a blistering agent on repeated occasions. What may be less recognized is that topical application can result in systemic absorption. Systemic toxicity from cantharidin results in episodes of diaphoresis, tachycardia, and sometimes hematuria. During King George's time, the concentration of the cantharidin was likely to be quite unpredictable. And given the frequency with which he had this ointment applied, it is certainly possible that he suffered some of the systemic effects from this terpenoid. This offers one explanation for his recurrent night sweats and an alternate explanation for intermittently discolored urine. Let's turn to the chief purgative agent used for the king. When the king had a bilious attack, the first line treatment was senna in order to expel bile in the stool. Senna is from the plant Cassia angustifolia. The extracts and teas are made from the seed pods and it contains anthraquinone glycosides that result in diarrhea. Senna is associated with black-brown discoloration of the urine. So now we can count two separate medicines that could have led to a urine color change. But there's some other low-hanging fruit to be had from senna. King George was given this medicine frequently for long periods of time, and laxative misuse is very readily associated with dehydration and electrolyte abnormalities. Maybe prolonged use of this medicine could have led to fatigue, muscle cramps, and the spasms that always tended to occur after he was already undergoing treatment. It would make sense that he would continue to have these symptoms when everything else had resolved, because they were still giving him laxatives. Another incredibly tempting cathartic given to the king is calomel. Why calomel? Because it contains inorganic mercury. How tempting is mercury? We know mercury can mimic infectious disease. It can cause GI upset, renal injury, that can cause peripheral edema and hematuria, it can cause rashes, it can cause tunnel vision, not to mention respiratory difficulties and personality and psychiatric changes. Just like porphyria, if you were not a toxicologist, you could look at these surface symptoms and say, hey, oh, I know what it was. King George had toxicity from mercury, and that would be the explanation. But as toxicologists, we know that when we examine these symptoms in detail, they simply don't match, right? The description of his skin rash did not match that of allodynia. His vision changes were not tunnel vision, but instead blurry vision and altered color perception. If he did develop renal or pulmonary toxicity from mercury, his symptoms would have been much longer lived, he would have likely had chronic illness in between episodes, or he would have just died. Also, mercury does not cause the very clear symptoms of mania displayed in the king. But most importantly, he was only given calomel on one or two occasions throughout all his years of illness, and the volume was simply not enough to cause toxicity. Okay, you've been waiting for it, now it's here. Let's talk about Peruvian bark. An exciting panacea at the time. It was thought to be a cure for any fever. It's exactly like it sounds. It's tree bark from Peru, brought to Europe, crushed into a powder, and administered to patients. Jesuit missionaries in Peru learned to recognize the tree bark from the indigenous peoples and brought the treatment to Europe in 1640s, about 100 years before King George was born. It was rumored to have saved the life of a Spanish countess in Peru, and it had become suddenly more popular when King George II, George's pop-pop, was cured of a severe illness with fever when he was a child. Now, it is most commonly referenced as Peruvian bark throughout his medical notes, but other names include Jesuit's powder and the countess's powder. Now, throughout time, it was indeed found to be a great cure for tropical diseases, especially fevers. But it was also found to have a number of significant side effects. Headaches, nausea, abdominal cramps, sometimes vomiting, tinnitus and hearing changes, flushing and sweating, sometimes rashes, and visual disturbances. So what tree in Peru was lucky enough to be called by the Europeans Peruvian bark? Well, a specific tree whose scientific name was named after the countess it had supposedly saved, the Countess of Cinchon. This is Cinchona, Succoruba calasaya or ligeriana, Peruvian bark, had quinine. King George II was treated with repeated doses of an unknown concentration of quinine throughout all his major illness episodes. His decreased vision and hearing were only noted later in his illness after he had been receiving this treatment. Now, his vision changes were particularly noted on one day after he had refused a very large loading dose of Peruvian bark. Could these symptoms have been explained by Cinchonism? Quinine in heavier doses can also cause intermittent skin rashes and sweating. Could King George have at one time been given too high a dose, leading to permanent blindness? Let's turn to a final substance that may have explained a lot more about his illness. King George was given emetics repeatedly in order to expel bile. He was given prolonged treatment multiple times a day, sometimes for weeks on end, and it was slipped into his food when he would refuse to take it. The chief emetic used during his time was emetic tartar. Emetic tartar is antimony potassium tartrate. So let's talk about antimony. Antimony, perhaps a lesser appreciated metalloid, may be something we don't often consider given its infrequent use and low frequency of poisoning in modern day life. Antimony has a quite fascinating history. It's been used for thousands of years in cosmetics for the production of rouge and black paint for eyebrows known as kohl. In medieval times, it was used for whooping cough, gout, and syphilis. And one of our favorite historical physicians, Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, who is Paracelsus, he loved antimony. He increased its topical application and he made treatments expand to leprosy and herpes and also mania and epilepsy. Now, for King George's time, the chief uses of this compound was for balancing the humors and for fever, pneumonia, and inflammatory conditions. But what's important to know is that antimony, in the form of a potassium salt, is in its inorganic, trivalent state. This is one of the most toxic forms of this metalloid. It binds sulfhydryl groups, leading to inhibition of a variety of metabolic functions, very similar to arsenic. In addition to causing abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, it can cause pancreatitis, hemorrhagic gastritis, diffuse muscle, and joint pains. Think of it as arsenic light, right? Chronic exposure can lead to a composite increase in cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease. Only in the 1800s was this therapy better appreciated to not only cause significant toxicity in the patients, but also fatalities. King George was receiving 120 milligrams every 6 hours for several days at a time. That correlates to 45 milligrams of antimony. I don't know what that means, but it seems like too much. Antimony could have certainly led to prolonged abdominal pain, joint and muscle pains, fatigue, and anemia. Perhaps prolonged use is also one of the contributors to the development of his dementia. Unfortunately, there are no simple ways to go back in time and check King George's body for antimony concentrations. Wait, or is there? In the early 2000s, some scientists decided to try and find genetic material from King George in order to test his DNA and confirm the presence of a mutation causing porphyria. They failed. They found hair in the storage of a museum. They could not extract any DNA to prove the wrong diagnosis. But later, a separate group of researchers had an additional thought. Maybe we can test the hair for toxins like heavy metals. Now, their primary interest was to see if he had unrecognized lead, mercury, or arsenic toxicity. These heavy metals were more often present as contaminants in the medicines at the time. To be clear, they didn't test for antimony, sorry. Womp womp. But they found some interesting stuff, so let's look. King George was found to have somewhat elevated levels of mercury and lead, much higher than we would accept or expect for someone today, but were actually kind of reasonable for somebody living in the 1700s. There was then a somewhat surprising result. The level of arsenic in his hair was quite high. Values greater than 1 part per million in hair are thought to correlate with arsenic toxicity that's strong enough to cause symptoms. King George's hair showed a concentration of 17 parts per million. This could have certainly been an explanation for a number of his different symptoms along with antimony. But where would it have come from? Arsenic was not known to be an ingredient or a contaminant or an ingredient in any of the medicines at the time. One explanation is the tartar emetic. Antimony is a metalloid that coexists with arsenic in nature. Evaluation of antimony-based medicines from the 1800s shows that arsenic may have contaminated these products an average from 2 to 5%. On days of the heaviest use of antimony to make the king vomit, this level of contamination may have exposed the king from anywhere to 3 to 9 milligrams of arsenic daily. Now, the minimal lethal dose is 60 milligrams. It is some degree of a prolonged excretion phase, though, and it could definitely accumulate with repeated dosing for several days, and this could have led to symptoms of chronic poisoning. Both antimony and arsenic help contribute to explain unusually prolonged abdominal pains, muscle pains, maybe even waxing and waning fevers, maybe skin rashes or neurologic changes. But where else would arsenic have come from? Isn't arsenic the king of poisons? Has not arsenic been used for thousands of years for poisoning and murder? King George ruled during the French Revolution. The political temperature during this time really changed public attitudes toward how acceptable it was to execute disagreeable leaders. Remember, King George himself had been the victim of at least 3 serious assassination attempts. He had his own share of infighting with his prime ministers, but especially with his son and heir to the throne, King George IV. Could an unknown individual close to the king have been afraid that the regency was threatened by Lord Bute and tried to poison him, leading to his initial symptoms in 1788? Though it's entertaining to postulate an unsuccessful poisoning attempt on the king, this is also quite unlikely the explanation for his symptoms. Arsenic in large doses is just fatal. He wouldn't have survived. The poisoner would have had to botch, what, 5 separate attempts, and all the symptoms were different throughout each episode. What the hair does show us is that people undergoing treatment in the 1700s and early 1800s were likely exposed to significant iatrogenic injury from the contaminants and medicines used to treat diseases during this time. There was no exception for the King of England. The true events that triggered his manic episode will never be known. I think it's unquestionable that he suffered from mania and bipolar disorder type 1. I also don't think there is a toxin that would unite both his physical symptoms and psychiatric symptoms. However, toxins may explain a number of his ongoing illnesses. The pattern of his illness and the inconsistency of symptoms from each episode makes porphyria a pretty unlikely diagnosis. Now, the dark urine could have been explained by a number of different sources, not only dehydration, but maybe cantharidin and especially senna. His intermittent joint and muscle pains could have also been due to dehydration from profuse use of cathartics and emetics, but there were other medicines that could cause muscle and joint pains, like quinine and exposure to heavy metals. I have a very strong suspicion that quinine was the source of his reversible vision and hearing impairment that only occurred after he got this medicine. His intermittent sweats and fevers could have also been caused by lots of his treatments, including cantharidin, quinine, or low-level heavy metal toxicity. King George III was a monumental figure and was the longest reigning male monarch in British history. It's undeniable that he suffered from episodes of severe, prolonged physical and mental illness. Through his trials, he has shown us the harms of overtreating patients. He serves as a warning that even when we think we can trust the medicines in current times, they could instead be leading to unrecognized iatrogenic injuries. Though His Royal Highness lost our American colonies, he navigated the British Empire through a period of revolution, survived 3 assassination attempts, and survived his medical and psychiatric care to reach the well-respected age of 81. And for that, he will remain a winner in my heart. Thank you.